Good afternoon, folks, and welcome to Alaska Gold Trails. I'm your host, Jim Madonna, from the University of Alaska Fairbanks Mining Extension. This is your radio show on mining in Alaska, past, present, and future. More specifically, folks, gold mining in Alaska's misty past, controversial present, and mysterious future. I'll be with you here on KFAR 660 on your radio dial each Thursday from 1 to 2 p.m., where we can discuss the entire spectrum of mining in Alaska, from the fascinating and colorful history of the major and minor gold rushes to the more recent gold prospecting and mining techniques. Also, we will have special guests to discuss different mining-related topics. Most of all, my friends, give us a call if you have a question or care to make a comment on mining in Alaska. Or maybe you just want to chat for a few minutes or want to share one of your more favorite frontier experiences. The number here is 479-TALK. That's 479-8255. Let's talk gold mining through the years along Alaska Gold Trails. Well, we got a good show planned for you today, folks. Let me give you a calendar of events. So we got some basic prospecting and rock and mineral identification classes coming up at the University of Alaska Mining Extension. They'll begin on October 10th. And if you'd like to know more about these public service mining and prospecting classes, give us a call at 474-7702 or 456-2569. Once again, that's rock and mineral identification for the beginner and basic prospecting techniques. The number, 474-7702. This afternoon, our guest is Betty Fahrenkamp. We'll be talking to Betty in just a few minutes. As you know, Betty's been a longtime Alaskan, and she's going to discuss what brought her to Alaska and many activities that she's been involved with since her arrival here. So with that, let's introduce our guest. Hello, Betty. How are you today?
I'm just fine, Jim.
Well, it's nice to have you on Alaska Gold Trails. You know, I've tried for a long time to get you on the show here. And, Betty, tell us, where did you come from?
Well, I was born in Tennessee, Jim, and then I came up here by way of Illinois to come to Alaska. And that's, you know, one of those stories. We all have them.
Well, wait a minute. You were born... Yeah. Now, wait a minute. You were born in Tennessee, and then you stopped in Illinois. Tell me a little bit about how long were you in Tennessee before you stopped in Illinois?
Well, I went to through high school in Tennessee and then went into service for 3 years, came back, used the GI Bill, and went through, got my bachelor's degree at the University of Tennessee, then started teaching, taught 2 years in Tennessee, and then took a job in Illinois teaching.
And what did you teach, Betty?
Band.
Top band.
Yeah, instrumental music. My major was math, and I thought I was going to be a math teacher. That's what I planned on doing. But I found I enjoyed very much. Music was my minor, and I enjoyed very much teaching instrumental music and band. And so I just started teaching there. That's where the vacancy was, and liked it. So I taught 2 years in Tennessee, then moved to Illinois and taught there for 6 years.
Uh-huh.
And I guess we're getting around to how I got up here, so...
Why would you want to move from there to here?
Well, tell you the truth, Jim, I didn't want to. My husband wanted to come up here. I was married to Gibb Fahrenkamp in Illinois in 52, and he had a friend named Van Bowman. I think everybody in town knows Van. And so Van and he used to work together in the insurance business in Illinois. And Van decided to come back to Alaska. Man, for 4 years, he kept saying, come on, Gibb, come on back up, and sending us cards, and Gibb always wanted to come up. And I kept saying, man, I'll freeze to death in that country. But then one day, I went to the superintendent of schools and asked for a raise, and he offered me $200 a year raise. That everybody knows I got a temper, and I kind of lost that temper of mine and went home with smoke coming out of my ears, and there was a wire from Dr. Ryan, who was then superintendent of schools here, offered me the job at Maine and Nordell and Denali. And so that was Tuesday. On Thursday, we left to come up here for 1 year. And that was 1956. So You can tell I didn't like it at all, and I didn't stay. I loved it, and I've been here ever since.
Now, how did you get here, Betty? Did you drive, you fly, you
take... We drove up.
You drove up.
Uh-huh.
And what was the Yelkan Highway like in 1956?
Well, I would compare it to the bottom of a creek bed that's gone dry. We were sitting on the housing anyway, and we took turns driving. One would sleep while the other drive, because from the front seat of our car to the back seat, we had it just loaded solid, you know. And then on top of that, we had, I think, a sleeping bag and a couple of white sheets when we started that turned out to be dark brown when we got here. And one of us would crawl over and sleep, another and drive. We made it in about 3 days.
You know, a lot of people talk about coming up the Yelkan. They say how many tires that they blew out along the way, and that some of them say, well, we carried 9 extras and we hobbled in on the last 4. Did you have that experience?
No, we didn't. The only thing that happened was we didn't have a single flat, and that's amazing because we kind of made time. As you can tell, it was some pretty rough territory. But the only thing we got was a hole in the gas tank, and because we didn't have the rubber matting underneath it.
Uh-huh.
And we had a kind of a bolt. I don't know what you call those bolts, but you put a piece of rubber underneath and screw the bolt in. And we screwed that bolt in, and we drove that car, I think, about 10 years after we got here. And kept the old bolt in there, never did get it fixed, and it never did leak. So that's the way we came in.
Well, I want to hear about what you did after you got here in just a few minutes. So let's take a look at a couple of our sponsors here.
A free dinner is waiting for you at the Bakery Restaurant. Just print 2-for-1 on any piece of paper and you'll receive a free dinner when you buy one of equal or greater value. This coupon is good from 4 to 10 p.m. Monday through Saturday. Don't wait, because this offer is only good until October 31st, 1988. So come on into the bakery with your 2-for-1 coupon and sample our delicious menu. The Bakery Restaurant at its new location, 69 College Road, next to Taco Bell.
He's a self-made man, a friend at the hiring hall. He's a fair, straight shooter, he's working for us all. Nilo took the fire for local high. Nilo stood the heat for UAF. Nilo Copeland gets things done.
You're invited to an Oktoberfest celebration for Nilo Friday, October 7th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Pump House. There'll be live German music, good German food, and plenty of good conversation and fun. Meet Nilo and help his re-election with a $20 donation this Friday from 6 to 9 at the Pump House.
Nilo stood the heat for UAM. Nilo took the fire for local hire. Nilo Copeland gets things done.
Paid by Copeland Campaign, 612 Spruce-Wood, Fairbanks.
Make your dining out memorable. Experience a romantic elegance of Vallata. Dine on succulent steaks, the freshest seafood, the ultimate in Italian cuisine, and authentic New York pizza. There is a difference. Vallata welcomes your special lunches and private banquets. Call Vallata for reservations at 455-6600 or stop by Vallata at the top of Belaine Road and Goldstream. For atmosphere, a spectacular view, and down-to-earth prices that haven't changed in over 7 years, it's Vallata.
Betty, tell us, what did you go right to work for the school district then when you arrived?
You bet. Uh-huh.
You did. Uh-huh. And in the music department.
Right.
You ran the band and...
I had band then in 4 schools, a junior high and 3 elementary schools.
And tell us, where were the location of these schools?
That was Maine, Nordale, University Park, and Denali.
So what did you do, hop from one school to the other during the day? Is that right?
Yeah, I'd spend the afternoons at the Maine Junior High. And that was the first year, and then the mornings in the other 3 schools. And at that time, we kind of did our own scheduling, and it was, maybe a 15-minute lunch period. If you've ever had dinner with me or lunch with me, Jim, you'll find I just gobble it down. It's my habit of 15-minute lunches. Is hard to break.
I want to remind the listening audience that we're here with Senator Betty Fahrenkamp, and if you'd like to give us a call and ask Betty a question, the number here is 479-TALK. That's 479-8255. So give us a call if you have a question. So you were hopping around and eating your 15-minute lunches and carrying on the work of teaching schools. Did you? How long did you stay teaching now? From 1956 up until when did you
1974.
Retire? 1974.
25. Well, it's 18 years here, but gave me 25 years of teaching. And at that time, you had to have 25 years to retire. And my husband, he got sick with cancer, and it was just a question of having to knock it off. I did.
Let's see, we got a call here. Betty, let's see what they have to say.
Okay.
Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. Betty?
Yes.
This is a problem that affects not only minors, but everybody else that wants and does use public land. Once the State Division of Parks takes over an area, all the uses inside that area stop except hiking and skiing, even though it was perfectly legal before the state park took it over. Is there any way you can change their attitude of everything's closed until open that the State Division of Parks has?
That's a good question, and one I've worked on for about 10 years. In most of the work that we've done, we have really stressed, and that means not just myself, but a lot of, you know, the people that have worked on this kind of an issue. And what we try to do is emphasize multiple use. But it seems that as long as there are two uses going, then they call it multiple use, and it's been a constant fight. And usually that comes about not through the legislation, but through rather the regulations that are put in to manage those areas. And I think you know that for, let's see, three times now, the legislature has had on the ballot trying to, a referendum or a proposition, trying to get some control of the regulatory process so that after the regs are written, we can affect those regulations. The way it is now, it's just by hit and miss. And three times that's been on the ballot, and three times it's been voted down. I think the reason for that is that there's a lot of lack of trust, not just a little, a lack of trust of politicians and the legislature. And it's been always perceived, in my estimation, as an attempt on the part of legislators to gain more power. And that's too bad because, you know, 60% of our time is spent in trying to help people cut red tape and find ways of making regulations where they work better to help people to do the job right rather than restrict them from being able to do whatever the activity is they want to do. And I don't know if that'll ever come up again, or I don't know how it's going to work out. I know I've had a bill in for the past 4 years. Last year it didn't get out of the first committee of regulation of review. It was never had a hearing except one time in Arlis Sterdzielewski's committee. But those, believe me, those two bills will be back in again. I'll be attempting again for us to get some kind of control of the regulatory process.
So I know it's bad enough that the federal government has no trespassing signs all over so-called public land, but it really gripes me when the state is starting to do it on state land, and the State Division of Parks closes everything that it has until they decide to open it at their convenience, which means that only special interest groups can use the state park lands, plus they don't allow access through state park lands to other public land. And also it worries me that the State Division of Parks wants the power to control all the trail systems in the state forests and on other state land, and with their attitude, I'm really a little bit leery that we'll find everything closed except a small group of people.
It's, I think you have fears that are well-grounded, and yet I think the people in the agencies think they're doing the right thing. I don't know if you remember the Chena Recreation Area when we had these berms pushed up so that you couldn't use the trails. If you remember, Don Bennett and I worked very hard on that.
I know Don Bennett helped open up the thing to horse use because it was all closed to horses.
Oh, yeah.
We've been there for ages.
Yeah. And that's not the intent when it goes in. So I think that things are looking up. I think there'll be a chance of that, but we've got to have in order to do that, some method of controlling the regulatory process. As it is now, we could put a bill in, but as you know, regulations and stuff are written by the administration and different area of government, and in order for us to get it done, it has to be approved by the governor and not vetoed. And to date, we haven't been able to handle that, get by that type of situation, because after all, the administration, it's their people who are making the regs. And I think a lot of people are sincere in trying to do things right and are hardworking, but many times the regulations are written by people who've never even seen it, the area they're regulating. So it makes it tough. And I appreciate your calling me on it. I certainly haven't given up in that area.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
Thank you for the call. Once again, you're listening to Alaska Gold Trails. Our guest is Senator Betty Fahrenkamp. If you'd like to give us a call and ask Betty a question, the number is 479-8255. And after a couple of announcements, we'll get back with Betty and talk more about her life and coming into the country.
So, you're thinking about joining the school band or orchestra? Well, get on with it. Get involved with your school band or orchestra activity with a musical instrument purchase from Music Mart. Music Mart carries a variety of musical instruments for beginners, amateurs, and professionals. And Music Mart will give you 20% off the price of your new instrument. Music Mart has a rental purchase program where all rental fees apply towards the purchase of your new instrument. Whether you want a new instrument or a used one, Music Mart has the right one for you at 5th and Noble Street.
It's the perfect getaway. The Getaway From It All special offer from Chena Hot Springs Resort. Just $99 buys deluxe overnight hotel lodgings for both of you. Dinner for two. Choose any item from the beef and seafood menu. And unlimited use of the swimming pool, hot tubs, and jacuzzi. But the $99 dinner and lodging offer is limited, so call 452-7867 now for reservations. For the getaway that's only an hour away, Chena Hot Springs Resort.
How can Seekins Ford Lincoln Mercury afford to guarantee their service repairs for life? Because Vern Baker remembers some advice he got from his dad.
Yeah, don't be a hammer mechanic. Use a little finesse, use a little ingenuity, use a little bit of common sense, I guess, more than anything. Whenever you're working on something, and before you get into a project, look at it, understand why you're doing it, and then attack it to the best of your ability.
Vern Baker guarantees he'll do the best job possible, and Seekins guarantees his repairs for life.
We'll show you how it works right here, right now, at Seekins Ford Lincoln Mercury. See you.
Well, Betty, it seems like you're pretty popular today. You got another call here. Hello there, you're on the air.
Well, howdy. Good afternoon on this fine, beautiful, typical Juneau afternoon. Betty should feel right at home.
Do you have a question for Betty?
Yeah, Betty. Recently, in the last few years, there's been a problem cropping up, and it's getting quite irritating. And now that it's wintertime, it's showing its face again. And that's the use of driving lights and fog lights on vehicles. Years ago, I put a set of lights on a rig, and everything was there that was needed, including instructions to hook it up so it could only be on when the highlights are on. Is there something could be done about that up here?
Maybe I'm missing something. You mean something done about people being sure they have their lights on? Is that what you're getting
at? How many times have you been driving down the road at night, and a guy comes at you, and he's got his headlights on, and then he's got a set of fog lights mounted on his bumper, and they're blinding you?
Yeah.
And you hit your high and low beam, you know, standard signal, please dim your lights, and the guy just keeps on a-coming and keeps on a-coming. And in the meantime, you're blinded. You can't see because his lights are so bright, not his headlights, but his driving lights or his fog lights.
Well, I think that's a beautiful example of why you can't control people's lives by setting laws that you can't regulate. You know, it is illegal not to dim your lights, so what happens? People just don't dim their lights sometimes. And that bothers me. It also bothers me to be driving on a day like yesterday, you know, and people not have a light on. So you, bingo, they're on you before you see them. I don't know. I think common sense is going to have to prevail there, and people are just going to have to learn the hard way, I guess, to dim their lights. And sometimes when they get somebody bash into them because they can't see, maybe they'll learn that dimming the lights helps.
Yeah, but in the meantime, you and I are laying alongside the road dead.
Yeah.
There are some states that do have a law that say that extra lights on a vehicle can have to be hooked up so they can only be turned on when the high beams are on.
Ah, now that's an idea. Why don't you call the... Do you know what states those are?
No, I sure don't. Like I said, I put a set of lights on one of the rigs I owned here a few years ago, and on the back of the box that came in were instructions in that wording and showing how to hook them up, so they're only hooked up to the high beams.
Yeah. Well, we'll look into that. But, you know, one of the bad things about everything we try to do to, you know, help protect people is that it always has some kind of downside as well, and that's where most of these, most of our laws that we're getting so many of come from, in trying to help alleviate a problem. Well, but we can certainly make a check on that. You want to say something, Jim?
I want to say that for a moment we're going to have to take a little break and listen to today's people. Thank you for the call,
hey,
my friend.
Thanks for calling.
Have
call
a good
Elvis,
day
now. Okay.
Bye.
So how good will Thursday Night TV be this season? We'll get a preview this evening with new episodes of Cosby in a Different World and the series premiere of a show NBC is very high on, Dear John, starring Judd Hirsch as a New York City school teacher who joins a singles and divorced support group. Punchline, the movie opening around the country tomorrow. Everybody's talking about Tom Hanks' brilliant performance. But don't forget about Sally Field, who says this role as a stand-up comic was the most challenging of her career.
I found the movie. I produced the movie. I didn't write the movie. I didn't direct the movie. That was David Seltzer. But I produced the movie along with Dan Melnick, and we sort of found the project, or was sort of discovered.
Johnny Carson goes prime time tonight in his 26th anniversary special. Congratulations to Lisa Marie Presley, Elvis and Priscilla's daughter. She and musician Danny Keough got married, and Barbara Streisand's Till I Loved You hit stores today. It's a duet with boyfriend Don Johnson. I'm Joanna Langfield.
Oh, boy, look at the time. Look, we can do this grocery shopping fast if you help me.
I'll get the TV Guide magazine.
Okay, the produce and meat, and you pick up soup and coffee.
I'll get the TV Guide magazine.
We'll get the TV Guide later.
I can't enjoy TV without TV Guide.
Well, I know,
it's
but
it's not
we're
just
in a...
listings. It's tons of fascinating stuff on television.
Then I'll get cat food, and you get
personalities
the
behind the scenes. Very well written,
are you
going
to help me, please, with the shopping or what?
Okay.
Thank you. Now, what are you going to get?
I'll get the TV Guide magazine.
No, you're not.
TV Guide magazine. Fun to read, tough to put down. The best thing on television.
Honey, what's this in my coffee?
Oat bran.
Oh, you've been sneaking oat bran in everything. Soup, salad.
It's good for you. Think about cholesterol.
Mm.
How's your toast?
Delicious.
That's some oatmeal goodness bread.
With oat bran?
In a low-fat, low-cholesterol diet, oat bran, eaten regularly, may help reduce serum cholesterol. And now, there's a way to help you get oat bran and love it. Oatmeal goodness bread.
Okay, the bread's delicious, but I...
Okay, no oat bran in the jelly.
New oatmeal goodness bread. The goodness of oat bran in a great-tasting bread.
Well, we're back here with Betty Fahrenkamp, and for those of you who are listening, if you'd like to ask a question of Betty, our number here is 479-8255. Okay, Betty, I think where we were, where you were teaching music and hopping around to a number of different schools here in the Fairbanks area, in 1956, and if I go back a couple of years before then, I came to Fairbanks in 1948, and I went to one school, and that was Main Street School, and I think the only other school was the Catholic school there, right at the bridge, Cushman uh-huh. Street Bridge now. And were the other schools in the area relatively new, or?
When I came?
Yes.
Yeah, 100 had just been built. Let's see, what else do we have? I think that was it. You know, with University Park, Denali, and Nordale.
Uh-huh. And so now tell us about a little bit about your husband. You know, he came in and He knew Van Bowman, and apparently he was a contact. And did he work construction then? Is that correct?
Yeah, he had a construction company. Well, he worked in insurance, and he was at the base for a while. And by the way, Jim, he ran for office. He ran for House before I ever ran. It wasn't successful, but he enjoyed it a lot. His main theme all through that was, you stay out of my election, and I did. But... he was mostly construction and was with Veterans Affairs for the state of Alaska before he passed away. But he was a lot of people here still remember him. He was a never saw a stranger, you know, friendly type of guy.
Uh-huh. So your adventure into politics wasn't your first contact with it, was it?
No, I got started, well, you know, when I was a kid, I used to work in... IDs and all this before I came here. But I had a student I was trying to reach, and if I remember correctly, it was sixth grade in Denali. And this student just would not apply himself, and he was just sharp as could be. So one day I asked him why he wouldn't work, you know, and he said, "Hey, why should I work?" I said, "You're a teacher, and my dad makes three times as much as you do." And I said, "What did your father do, honey?" And he says, "Well, he's a janitor here at school." At that time, we didn't call it maintenance man, and that kind of made me mad, so, because he was right. And so I went to work on the precinct level and stuff. So I'm, by a fluke, everything's happened to me. It just seems to be by accident or just happens. But I was active in, you know, on the precinct level and stuff, never been to central committee. And I remember Jack Frakey called me one day and said, "Betty, we need a vice chair in the central committee. Would you consider taking it?" And I said, "Gosh, I don't know what to do over there. I've never even been to a central committee meeting." He talked me into it. I went to the first meeting. I never saw Jack there again since, and started from then. I became the first chair, woman chair, or female chair of the central district, and that's what it used to be then. And that really got me started here in politics. And then after retiring from school teaching, I was at that time national committee woman for the state of Alaska, and held that post for 6 years. And as most of you know, worked for a U.S. senator after I retired. And one day, you know, we used to have four time zones here. And one day, John Butrovich, whom I always supported, did not sign up for to run again. And that was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and at that time it was 5 o'clock here. Well, Charlie Parr and Fred Brown, a whole bunch of the people who were in the legislature then started calling me and said, "Hey, you know, you either get somebody to run, you're the national committee woman, it's your job, you get somebody to run, or you run." So 25 minutes before they closed up, I signed up and ran for office, and that was 1978. And I've loved it. I think everything I've ever done, Jim, was, you know, just getting ready for the job that I have now, because I love it.
Uh-huh. Who'd you run against?
Let's see. In that election, there were 8 of us to start with, but I can remember it was Larry Carpenter and John Huber and Don Bennett and myself. Mm-hmm. And from that, 2 would be elected, and that turned out to be Don Bennett and myself.
That was the second year that Don Bennett ran, was that correct?
Right, uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And so, you got elected. Were you prepared for what your first experience when you went to Juneau?
Oh, I think pretty much so, because I'd been down there, you know, and I'd been working with politics and very hands-on for 3 years, and I'd been national committee woman for 6. But I think one of the things that was very good, I happened to be in the minority for a couple of years, and that gave me a good learning curve period in order to get ready before I started chairing committees, et cetera. And it's always a learning curve. I've been there 10 years, and I'm still learning.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, I'm not one of these that thinks politics is a dirty word. I like politics. It's in everything.
A lot of people like you, too, Betty. You got another call here.
Okay.
Hi, you're on the air. You
Hi,
a question
Betty,
for Betty?
This is Lynette.
Well, hello, Lynette. How are you?
I am fine. I just heard you on the radio and thought I'd call up and see what the heck you've been up to.
Uh-huh. You couldn't didn't have any trouble recognizing this gravel girdy throat, huh?
Not at all.
Uh-huh. Haven't seen you in quite a while. I've been great. You know, this summer's been a very busy one since I've been chairing the Western Conference, and it's been very productive, and I've really enjoyed it, but that part's over now. I'm a past chair, so I'll be able to go and not have to work so hard and not have to go so much and be home more.
All right. Well, it's good to have you home and hear you on the air.
Oh, thanks, Lynette. It's good to talk to you, honey.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call, Lynette. Well, let's. I want the folks at home to get out their pencils and their paper and listen very closely to this next ad. Let's see what this guy has got to say here.
Enjoy learning rock and mineral identification, or perhaps basic prospecting techniques. This is Jim Madonna from the University of Alaska Mining Extension Program. If you're interested in either one of these fascinating classes, they will begin on October 10th. Give us a call today at 474-7702 or 456-2569.
Well, now, that was pretty nice. What did you think of that, Betty? I can't imagine.
I thought I recognized the voice, Jim.
I thought I had it pretty well down. When you went into office, you carried with you a pretty strong support for the mining community of Interior Alaska, and I guess that's only proper since they are your constituency and that you do understand the mining industry of the interior and probably are pretty familiar with mining throughout the state of Alaska now, and you've supported mining in a big way. Tell us some of the problems that you encountered when you first went down. Was it a positive attitude about mining in your early years as a senator?
No, Jim, I don't think so. You know, the thing that really amazes me is that from the time of the Russians till sold to the United States, mining is what developed our country, and I don't think a lot of people realized just the impact that mining and placer mining especially had on this area. And being an old coal miner's daughter, I'm not afraid of the mining aspects, and I know you can mine and mine properly, and we all talk about diversified economy. Heavens to Betsy, we don't need to kill off one that's already in existence and it's been there forever. And the miners here have really worked from the time they started. They were used to having a pretty good bit of independence, and then with the time of statehood and all the regs and all this stuff, it was hard for them to adjust to, you've got to have mining ponds, you've got to have your water coming out clear and all this. So, but they have worked very hard, and I think anybody will agree that our streams are looking better. Mining's going better, except it's harder on the placer miners. They're, to work with a threat of a $25,000 a day fine on your head, not many people would go into business that way. They just happen to love it. Most of it's mama-papa organizations are, and they're really hard-working people. And I think that, I can see a bright light on the horizon, but like them, sometimes I get discouraged. It's just that it's we don't have as many miners in the field as we have used to have. We have a lot more regulations. We have cleaner streams as well. And we've had some reports that have come from various research agencies that I think were just off the wall in what the real effects of mining were. And I think people are beginning to understand that today, and that fish can live, and that recreation can go on, and that mining can go on without destroying the land. So that's my feeling on it. Miners were my constituency, and I feel like they needed the support because they were in trouble. They still are. They're not out of the woods, but it's improving. If you can say with less miners, it's improving, but at least there are fewer complaints.
Prior to 1974, Betty, mining was depressed in the state, and of course, if I recall correctly, in 1974, Gerald Ford then signed a bill that permitted free ownership of gold, and we could trade it among one another mm-hmm. without government restrictions. And at that time, gold was, of course, $35 an ounce, and it slowly rose. And as it rose, of course, more and more people entered the mining game, and in a few short years, in the mid to late 70s, it rose up above $200 an ounce. And as it rose above $200 an ounce, a great flood of people came into Alaska and began mining the various creeks and drainage systems. And they had two very big problems. And the first of those problems during the mining of that gold was that they recognized that these single-channel sluice boxes, and this is touching on technology now, if you wish, mm-hmm. that these single-channel sluice boxes were losing a large proportion of the fine gold.
That's why they're redoing some of that today.
That's right. And you've had a couple of programs which redid the tailing piles. Well, what happened then is they recognized the benefit of multiple channel sluice boxes, which permitted a decrease in water energy traveling through the channels and thereby collecting a higher percentage of the fine gold. And as a result of that, the miners began mining leaner and leaner ground. So there was one chap here in central Alaska who took the initiative, and he began constructing multiple channel sluice boxes, and that's Hector's Welding out there at 13 Mile Richardson Highway. Hector started constructing these multiple channel sluice boxes. They refined them, they put in more advanced riffle systems and undercurrents and things of that nature, and where the single-channel sluice boxes were only collecting perhaps 40, 50, and 60% of the fine gold fraction, these new multiple-channel sluice boxes produced by Hector's Welding were collecting up 60, 70, and as high as 80% of the fine gold fraction. And this is an example of the technology that was put into place. And I'm proud to say that it happened right here in Interior, Alaska. Hector's Welding is located, like I said, at 15-mile Richardson Highway near North Pole. And for all you miners out there like to know his phone number, it's 488-6432. And Hector's, you know, you just go to about any placer mining operation in the state that's using a sluice box, and it's going to have Hector's on the side of it, because Hector's is the El Primo sluice box. Believe me, in the world, I've traveled to New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and it's Hector's sluice boxes that are the top of the line.
Well, you know, one thing I think a lot of people here may not recognize, Jim, along that way, is that Alaska and the placer miners of Alaska are the models. They're the models for Australia. They're the models for any place else in the world for placer mining. They are supposed to be doing the best, using the best technology, having cleanest operations, the best recovery, and they're models. And what are we doing? We're trying to kill off the model of the world? You know, it just doesn't make sense to me.
It was interesting to note that I was over in Canada here just a month or so ago, and the people over there say that they wait for our placer mining conference proceedings to get out so they can learn what the latest in technology is in the placer mining industry. And that was kind of a reward to find that we are looked upon as the model of placer mining in the world. Taking that a step farther, remember I said that there were two things that the miners were confronted with. Well, the second thing was that during the 1970s, of course, Hector sluice box came in, and they began collecting more and more of this fine gold. They had big jars full of gold, buckets full of gold, but they didn't have any place to sell it. So what happens? Enter Oxford Assaying Refining. So Oxford Assaying Refining set up shop in town, and their role was to buy the gold from the miner. So then the miner, of course, could go out and spend the money in the town. Well, the procedure that works there is that Oxford would buy this gold, and then they would melt it down into what we call a Dory bar and analyze it to determine just how much gold and silver was in the bar. And then they would pay the miner based on that assay. These Dory bars then were sent out to the refinery, which refined them, and they took that gold and they poured that gold, that refined gold, which was generally what they call 999 gold, into a 400-ounce good delivery bar. And that good delivery bar then would be traded on the market, in the marketplace, in the stock exchange trades that go on. But in addition to the buying of the gold, Oxford also has a number of other activities that they're involved with. They use the silver that they purchased and made coins and ingots and quite beautiful medallions.
I've collected some of those.
I think just about everybody in Fairbanks has collected some of the Oxford ingots. And in addition to that, they sell the silver eagles and the United States gold coins, the Canadian maple leaves, and the other kinds of coins. And they also sell, you know, they have a lot of nuggets coming across the counter, and they have on occasion some very nice nuggets there. And people go in there, and I know I've done this. I've gone into Oxford Assaying Refining. They're located, by the way, at 208 Wendell Street. And I've gone in there and purchased a nugget that was just right for the person that I had in mind. And I would take that down and have a chain put on it or have it mounted on a bracelet or something. And it would serve as that special little gift for that someone special.
Yeah, and they can usually tell you what mine it comes from.
Yeah, that's right.
To me, that's great, you know, to know. Two, you've got a nugget and you like it. Well, where'd it come from? You know immediately, or they can tell you where it came from, and that's a neat part too.
Well, you know, and it comes down to the final conclusion of the thing is that we've got a town here that does have an industry that's very important, and we do a lot of things with that industry. Not only do we have manufacturers in business? Do we have a company like Oxford in business that also supplies the coins and the other kinds of gold materials necessary to as presents and gifts for the people around? And by the way, if people are interested, but I should point out that Oxford's phone number is 456 356-3967. That's 456-3967. And they have a hotline. So if you ever want to know what the price of gold, silver, or platinum is, you can call their quote line, which is 452-7858. And I'd like to remind the listening audience that sometimes I hold contests here on Alaska Gold Trails, and during the contest period, we like to talk about our sponsors, and it's nice for the listening audience to know just who the sponsor is, where the sponsor is located, the phone number, and what they do, because sometimes these contests can be worth dinner for two, silver ingot, or something of that nature. Very nice prizes. So with that, let's talk more about Betty here.
Well, Jim, I'd just like to say while we're on that, though, that, you know, a lot of activities in this community, they not only do the people you've mentioned provide a service, but they're also very nice in helping out with causes within the community, as many of our businesses are. And I'm real pleased that I know them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've been very nice to me. Well, what do you want to know about Betty?
What do I want to know about Betty? Well,
yeah.
I want Betty to talk about what she has done specifically, what types of things she's contributed to the mining industry in way of research, in way of improving the mining community's efforts in perhaps water quality, fine gold recovery, things of that nature. Have you had your hand in bills and regulations that would help the mining community?
Well, I like to think so, at least, Jim. You know, in the 10 years I've been in the legislature, I spent 8 of those in the Resources Committee, and 4 of those chairing. And I was able to get through with the help. You know, it's not, I'm no expert miner. I have to depend on people within the industry or within the departments to tell me how we can help. And we've had mining loan programs. We put in a revolving loan fund. We've had the grants and technology funds. And I like to think maybe I had something, you know, a helping hand in us being number one in the country in our technology, because we've been able to say, hey, if you can find a better way, and a way that will clean up the stream, or a way that will increase recovery with the use of less water, so that we have less dirt in the streams, then we've got grants and things available. And so in those areas, I've been very active, not just myself. You know, nobody gets anything done down there by themselves. Mm-hmm. You have to convince other people that it's for a good cause, and that it's going to be helpful to the state. But I've enjoyed working with the miners. I've had disappointing times, as they have. And sometimes I feel like, well, I really haven't accomplished very much. But if we look back, we now, you know, that we do have the settling ponds, we do have the technology, we do have cleaner streams, and we have heap bleaching going on. We have the classes in school. A lot of people wondered, hey, you know, mining, what's mining? It's just something that messes up our streams. But if you look around your room and just look at what would not be in that room if it weren't for mining. And how many times do we stop and think about that, you know? I remember when we were first trying to get the classes in school and the books written that were appropriate for Alaska. I looked at a telephone and an aspirin and all these things, and I thought, what? This is mining? Well, of course it is. We're just not aware of it as we go through. And now we're working on mixing zones and trying to make both a little easier for the miner and yet protect the fish life, you know, and all of us like the fish. We all like good environments, and so do the miners. You know, they're not people that like to rape the country. They're part of us. When we talk about miners, we're talking about our neighbors.
It was interesting to note that one of the DEC representatives gave a paper at the PAST, Placer Mining Conference, and he pointed out that 98% of the miners are effectively treating their water, and that it's within the limitations. And it indicates that, you know, some of the levels are achievable.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. And the miners are working hard to do it.
Yeah. Now, in some instances, you know, in all areas, maybe complete recycling is not going to work in some areas. But And some of it makes it uneconomical, and we've had mines to close. But I think now, Jim, and maybe I'm wrong, but I think that most of those people who are on the creeks today will be able to stay. Even whether they're going into the 5 miles, you know, they may not have as much production. I mean, the 5-acre stuff. They may not have as much production, but at least those that are there are stayers and are really trying to work to stay within limitations and yet keep a viable industry going. Mm-hmm. And now we have more, you know, of the hard rock mining as well. The dredging out at Nome is going well, and all that whole peninsula, Ruby area, the McGrath area. It's Juneau area, Ketchikan area. Mining is still a very viable and big part of the state, whether it's in gold mining or whether it's in lead, zinc, or whatever. I'm not all doom and gloom in this. I think it's looking up. I think we've bottomed out. We're getting better understanding. And at least I'm hopeful that from now on we're on the way up, mm-hmm. rather than losing more of our industry.
Some of the operations that are going into effect at the moment are showing methods of doing things which are satisfactory to some opposing interest groups.
Yes.
And that it is possible to get there, even though it's a little bit more rigorous. Let's take a listen to these folks right here.
When the doors close tonight at Nerland's Home Furnishing, they will restock, restack, and reorganize and take further reductions on selected items in every department to get ready for the final days of the 6th annual National Home Furnishing Sale. This nationwide sale event is so big that it can only happen once a year. This is your last chance to save like never before on fine Nerland's quality furniture at incredible National Home Furnishings sale prices. You don't want to miss further reductions on already low sale prices on items throughout Nerland's huge selection of sofas, recliners, dining sets, mattresses, bedroom sets, sectionals, and more. The 6th annual National Home Furnishing Sale is almost history. It's almost gone. Almost history. Don't miss the sale that's so big, it only takes place once a year at Nerland's Home Furnishings, 545 3rd Avenue.
Nerland's is open special hours today from noon till 8 p.m.
Hi there, you're on the air. You have a question for Betty?
I think we may have lost them.
Might have lost them. Well, with that in mind, I did want to bring out one point that recently the University of Alaska Mining Extension has initiated the Aid to the Miner program, and we worked on that program. A lot of volunteer work was put into it, and we found that there was an area there where we could contribute to the benefit of the mining industry in terms of water quality, fine gold recovery, plant selections, and property evaluations. And after a couple of years of testing around, we came to the folks down there. I went through you and Mark Boyer, as a matter of fact, and I requested $10,000 to be used specifically for aid to the miner. That was not any wages involved in that, but simply the travel and the support materials and the publication of the studies so that we could make these learning experience available to the mining industry, not only within the state here, but perhaps Canada and nationally. And the result of that is, with our background, and I think that that played a big role in it, and your enthusiasm, and Mark Boyer's enthusiasm, we did get the $10,000 grant, and we used it this past year to go out to the mines. We made several successful studies, and I think that in the long run we will be able to publish all the work for the past 3 years and make it available. And I wanted you to know before we close out the show that we certainly appreciate what you've done for us here, and we're looking forward to getting the publication out, Betty.
Oh, well, I'll be looking forward to that too.
And I just have one other little question for
you.
We don't have any calls left. I'm here with Betty Fahrenkamp, Senator Betty Fahrenkamp, and we've had a number of fine calls. I would like to know, is the current administration pro-mining? Are they against mining? Are they standing kind of in the middle of the road on this? And answer here.
I think they've been trying to help, and particularly in that agencies now are really working together to try to make it possible to find the answers. And we've been working towards that for a lot, long time.
You have?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so it looks like we're on the road back up to a successful and profitable mining industry in the state of Alaska.
Certainly hope so.
Well, Betty, guess what? I hate to tell you.
Don't tell me the time's gone already.
The time has gone already. It's the end of the show. And I want to thank you very much for joining us here.
It's been fun.
And loved it. I also want to thank the listening audience for taking part in the program. Next week's guest is Dr. William R. Wood, a guy that everybody knows. It's been fun, folks. This is Jim Madonna on Alaska Gold Trails. Until next week, happy prospecting.